Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 30th of April. The US and Britain call on Hamas to accept the latest deal for a temporary ceasefire with Israel. The American State Department has found that five units of the Israeli military were responsible for gross rights violations before the war in Gaza. And the top clubs in English football have provisionally agreed a cap on spending. Also in the podcast...
9 out of 10 of the highest-grossing films of all time are 2 hours or longer.
But what exactly is the ideal length for a film? I'll give you a clue. It's not 3 hours. For months, Israel and Hamas have been negotiating indirectly over a hostage and ceasefire deal. The previous one at the end of November lasted a week. Since then, hopes of a new agreement have been raised and dashed several times. Now, with Gaza on the brink of famine and pressure building on the Israeli Prime Minister to bring home the remaining hostages, there is optimism that a breakthrough could be near. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is currently holding talks in Saudi Arabia.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly. So we're looking to that, and I'm hopeful that they will make the right decision, and we can have a fundamental change in the dynamic.
Hamas has said it has no major issues with the offer, which is said to include new wording on a cessation of hostilities. It has previously called for a permanent ceasefire, while Israel says it will continue fighting until it has defeated Hamas, including fighters holed up in Rafah. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Frank Gardner, has the latest.
Well, not for the first time, there is a cautious sense of optimism, both here and in capitals around the Middle East, that... this isn't the end of the Gaza war, but there could be some kind of a breakthrough in ceasefire talks. Why? Because for the first time we're seeing some really quite considerable concessions being talked about. Nothing's firm yet, nothing's actually been publicised, signed, agreed, announced. But what's being debated is the permission by the Israeli military for large numbers of Palestinian displaced people currently who are sheltering in the south of the Gaza Strip in the city of Rafah, to move back to their homes in the north. That's something that Israel had resisted in the past. Israel, reportedly, would also remove some of its forces from Gaza. This would be during a 40-day truce. And there would, of course, be the exchange of hostages and prisoners. Probably hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinian prisoners coming out of Israeli jails, in return for a rather lower figure than was originally demanded by Israel, an initial figure of around 33 Israeli hostages. Now, from the Israeli side, there is dual pressure going on here. Pressure from the United States to do this deal, and pressure domestically from all the families and friends of the hostages who have been demonstrating and shouting louder and louder against the government here, your policy isn't working. The Netanyahu government has always insisted that the only way, the best way to get the hostages out is by military pressure. But it's not working. It's not producing any results. And they can see that. And every day that goes by increases the risk that more of those hostages will die in one way or another. So there is as I say, this cautious optimism that this time it's possible that the differences between the two sides, while not narrowed completely, are narrowing, and we might well know the answers in the next 72 hours of whether this deal is going to fly or fail.
Our security correspondent Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. And the Hamas delegation has now left Egypt, and it says it's planning to return with a written response to the ceasefire proposal. As well as putting pressure on Israel over its actions in Gaza, the US has also expressed concern about the behaviour of the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank. Now, following an investigation, the American State Department has concluded that some members of the Israeli security forces have committed human rights violations before the war in Gaza. Here's our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
In a first-of-its-kind decision, the State Department says it has determined that five units of the Israeli security forces carried out gross violations of human rights. It hasn't detailed the incidents, nor the units involved, but they are all believed to have taken place in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem in recent years, but before the current war in Gaza. Under American law, such a finding means units can be barred from receiving US military assistance unless the State Department is satisfied the cases have been dealt with and justice pursued by the country involved. It says this has taken place with four of the five units. While it was reportedly on the brink of cutting military aid to a fifth, it now says Israel gave it new information and it will make a decision after it consults with the Israeli government. The administration is denying accusations it's buckled under political pressure over that case, widely reported to involve an IDF battalion which was investigated over the death 2 years ago of an 80-year-old Palestinian-American man who was bound and gagged by soldiers during a village search.
Tom Bateman in Washington. Meanwhile, the US has singled out the United Arab Emirates among a group of countries it says must stop providing support to the warring military factions in Sudan. America's UN envoy said the Sudanese army and the rival RSF militia were both receiving support, which was leading to the destruction of Sudan and the displacement of millions. Here's our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
The US ambassador to the UN said history was repeating itself in Darfur in the worst possible way. Linda Thomas-Greenfield was referring to the ethnically driven killings that took place 2 decades ago in this region in the west of Sudan. She said once again villages near Al-Fashir were being razed to the ground by the RSF and its allied militias and warned of an imminent attack on the whole city. American officials hope they can persuade the United Arab Emirates to stop backing the RSF. The US ally has denied giving the support. 8 million people have been displaced in Sudan, and so far all efforts at peace talks have failed.
Will Ross. Well, next to Kenya, and as we record this podcast, the authorities there say at least 50 people have died after a dam collapsed. Torrential rainfall washed away part of a village and the number of dead is expected to rise. The Red Cross says it's rescued more than 100 people. At least 130,000 people have been displaced by flooding across Kenya as the region is hit by a severe rainy season. Our Kenya correspondent Barbara Platasha reports from the scene.
A group of men is trying to move a battered car. It's stuck in the mud next to a gouged-out riverbank in a place where houses used to stand. A roaring sound woke people here at 3 o'clock in the morning as a tide of water crashed down from a burst dam upriver. Deden Moirori said before he had time to think, he was up to his neck in water. He saw the flood take his wife and was swept in the opposite direction, but he was able to grab a tree branch and hang on. Many others weren't so fortunate. Peter Moinyingi said he spent a frantic night trying to pull people out of the flood or digging them out of the mud and the branches of broken trees.
There are little babies in the water, older people, and people are screaming, people are crying, people are losing their lives, people are losing their loved ones.
The rain started again mid-afternoon, and the forecast is for more. What happened here was a disaster, but government officials have warned that dams in other parts of the country are full to the brim. They're telling people they need to be prepared to move quickly.
Barbara Platasha in central Kenya. For more on the rescue operation, Paul Henley spoke to Michael Ayabe, head of disaster management at the Kenyan Red Cross. First, he spoke about conditions in the area.
Nairobi and the surrounding West Highlands of Rift Valley have been receiving lots of rain in excess of even 50 millimeters within 24 hours. And this has been consistent over the last 1 week. Now, what this has caused is that the soils have become saturated and could most likely be the reason that led to that dam finally breaking its bank and lots of water running downstream in excess of 100 meters. And therefore, water gained lots of acceleration, sweeping a village into the town of Mai Mahiu, where it has caused high fatalities. Search and rescue efforts are in place. The survivors have been taken to hospital with government agencies working with the Red Cross all together in this.
And you have Red Cross people on the ground. What are they saying the scene looks like now?
The water levels seem to, of course, have gone down, but lots of debris all over, meaning you cannot clearly say whether in some sections you have people or not. They can see images that they've sent from ground of vehicles that have been swept off and damaged by debris that ran into them. And you could even see some furniture that was also swept by this heavy flood water. It's quite early to say how many people would have been there. We've opened up a missing persons registration desk for those who will report that their loved ones are missing.
And I know these aren't even the first deadly floods in Kenya this month. The country's been experiencing unprecedented rainfall, hasn't it? Lake Victoria is overflowing, effectively.
Sure. And remember, Lake Victoria gets water from the other East African countries, including Uganda and Tanzania, that are also experiencing heavy rains. Lake levels have gone up, meaning more displacements of population happening. And what we also saw yesterday in one of the towns, Homa Bay, bordering the lake, there was a flood storm coming from highlands, and it swept through houses. We have fatalities there and displacement. So we are also dealing with a search and rescue mission on that end. On the eastern part of Kenya, we also have Tana River, where we have check dams, which are used for electricity generation, but they are also full. And therefore, all the water from the highlands is now going down and displacing lots of population. Unfortunately, yesterday we had a boat that capsized. We have found 3 bodies, reducing the number of those who are missing to 17.
Do you need more foreign help?
We need support for shelter, water treatment, food, especially for these people, because they lose everything, and plans for resettlement. Most of them are actually in schools and churches, and the amenities there are not enough for kind of population that we're seeing.
Michael Ayabe, head of disaster management for the Kenyan Red Cross. The Mona Lisa, arguably the world's most famous painting, could get a room of its own in the Louvre in Paris after the museum's president said visitors deserved the best possible experience. So will the 9 million people who flocked to see Da Vinci's masterpiece agree this is an improvement? Paul Henley spoke to art critic and lecturer Estelle Lovat. What does she think of it being moved?
I think it's perfect timing now, especially as Paris is going to be hosting the Olympic Games this summer. So they're counting on inundated footfall at the Louvre. But it's also good PR. You know, everybody has heard of the Mona Lisa. She's the rock star of the Renaissance art world. She's got a fandom. It's almost like being Taylor Swift or Madonna. Everybody wants to see her and everybody wants to have a selfie taken with her. And that's one of the disappointing things, actually, as an experience for visitors. You've got the Mona Lisa, which is very small. Actually, the late Queen of France, Marie Antoinette, back in the 18th century, said that the Mona Lisa is far too small and too dark. And now that we've got all these visitors, and she's behind bulletproof glass, anti-reflective glass, it's very difficult to see her. It's her enigmatic smile that's been idolised by art lovers. So the chance to see it in a new location, given that she'll be given her own basement room, I'm not really surprised, because she actually has her own mailbox. She gets delivered love letters and bouquets of flowers.
I suppose the essential question is whether it will make it more difficult funneling the huge numbers of visitors in and out of a single room. It's already highly regimented, isn't it?
That's a very good question, Paul. Yes, you can wait in a queue for 2 hours to see her if you're lucky for 8 seconds. But there will be an entrance for visitors to bypass the current glass pyramid entrance and go directly to the underground room that is devoted for her. You know, it's quite extraordinary, really. Does she need her own space? At the moment, she is sharing the gallery room with other 16th century Venetian artists who have very big works of art. So I think it's a good idea to try it. I can't say that visitors will enjoy it anymore, but they will be able to say, I was there, for this current hashtag FOMO, fear of missing out on it.
Just in a few words, Estelle, is she worth it? Why do you think, as an art critic, would you say that the quality of the painting merits this level of fame?
Well, Da Vinci himself said it wasn't his best painting. You know, it is valued at something like $800 million, but it's priceless, so you can't really put a price on it. It's not his greatest, no. But don't forget, he was more interested in science and invention than he was in painting.
Art critic and lecturer Estelle Lovett. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
In 2015, I went out in Amsterdam, and then I had to pee, but all the bars and cafes and all the other places were closed. I searched for an alley.
A victory for women in Amsterdam after the city authorities announced they're spending millions on more public toilets.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe. From people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It was one of the most destructive wildfires Greece has ever seen. In 2018, flames swept through the seaside town of Mati, leaving more than 100 people dead. But it wasn't simply a natural disaster. A report found a catalogue of official failures, and now 6 people have been convicted over the blaze. I heard more from our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
The summer of 2018 saw a terrible heatwave across Europe with lots of wildfires. But the worst of these were in July in the coastal area around the Greek capital, Athens. They were accompanied by high winds, which meant they spread very quickly. And the worst hit was this resort town of Mati. What happened there was truly horrible. I mean, it happened so fast. Many people burned to death in their homes. Some ran into the sea and drowned. Rescuers found 26 corpses together. Apparently, they were all hugging each other as they died. Now, right from the start, there were complaints that this death toll did not need to have been so high. People complained that there'd been no warning. There were really horrible allegations that at one point drivers were being directed to flee towards an area already on fire, and they burned to death in their cars. And an official report less than a year later confirmed many of these allegations. It said there'd been mismanagement by the police and the fire service, as a lack of coordination which had caused chaos and a collapse of the system, and it referred to criminal mistakes, hence the trial which ended in Athens on Monday.
Yeah, and what happened in court?
There were 21 people on trial, a local governor, other figures from local government, officials from the emergency services, also a man who'd been burning wood in his garden and was said to have started one of the fires. Now, of these 21, six were found guilty, five officials for involuntary manslaughter and negligence. The man who was burning wood in his garden, he was found guilty of involuntary arson. They were given various prison sentences, some of them suspended, but, and this is, I suppose, a strange aspect of the Greek legal system, all six of them were let off going to prison in return for paying a fine. And crucially, of those 21, all of the local government people on trial, they were all acquitted.
Yeah, and the families are very unhappy about it.
They really were. I mean, as those verdicts came out, they yelled out shame. They said justice hadn't been done. One shouted, "Your court is an insult to the dead." A lot of people just broke down and sobbed. Now, family representatives said they're going to try and get some of these acquittals overturned on appeal and the sentences toughened. But whether that's actually going to be possible, I think at this stage, it's still unclear.
Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss. Football now, and according to the book Soccernomics, there is a direct relationship between a club's wage bill and its position in the English Premier League. Put simply, the more a team pays its players, the better it does. Now, in an attempt to keep the Premiership competitive, clubs have agreed in principle to back a spending cap, as I heard from our senior sports news reporter Laura Scott.
What this would be is another financial control to effectively tie the spending power of any club to a percentage, basically a multiple, of the television revenue and prize money of the lowest earning side. So effectively, all of the clubs would be governed by the same upper limit or salary cap or spending cap, although this is being termed anchoring. It isn't yet in force. What they've agreed to today is to further explore the potential to introduce this kind of model. So they've basically given permission for the Premier League to do the final financial and legal analysis that's required for the model and draw up the rules. Those would then be voted on potentially in June at the Premier League's AGM. So we're still quite a long way from this spending cap being introduced, but today is a significant moment because you've got 16 of the 20 Premier League clubs saying, actually, yes, you can go on and develop this potential model ready for a vote.
So what would that mean for teams like Manchester City and Newcastle with rich owners?
Well, we know that Manchester United are one of the clubs who voted against developing these proposals today. Newcastle seemingly in favour of at least exploring the opportunity. Theoretically, what it's meant to do is try to level out the competitiveness of the Premier League. We are anticipating that Manchester City will win a fourth Premier League title in a row. Well, is that a competitive league? You know, that is up for discussion. But then what they don't want to do is stifle Premier League clubs' abilities to compete with their European counterparts. And that is the opposition that you get from the likes of Manchester United, Manchester City and Aston Villa, which are that if you put everyone on the same cap, you are stifling their ambition. You're actually punishing people who've grown their revenues over the last few years. And that's not a way to run a competitive league.
Laura Scott. Now, he's one of the world's most popular yoga gurus, but Baba Ramdev has fallen foul of the courts in India over misleading adverts about his traditional medicine products. He has more than 10 million subscribers to his YouTube channel, where he promotes his remedies, often while doing yoga.
Hair care ke naam par, skin care ke naam par, dental care ke naam par, home care ke naam par.
Well, regulators have now suspended manufacturing licenses for 14 of his products, including traditional medicines for asthma, bronchitis and diabetes. Our South Asia editor Anvarasen Etarajan takes up the story.
Well, he's very well known in India for his TV shows where he was promoting various Ayurvedi products produced by his pharmaceutical companies. As you know, in India, the traditional medicine is very popular. You know, in the absence of health centers in rural areas, people have long been using these traditional medicines. And that's where Baba Ramdev came into picture by producing several products, which he claimed can cure various illnesses. And that led to controversy over the years. Now, you know, this has caught on, the imagination where people are buying, and it is now, it's believed to be, is worth more than $2 to $3 billion, according to Indian media reports, and they sell ranging from toothpaste to various products. And he really got into trouble when, during COVID crisis, when he launched a tablet, Coronil, saying that it will cure the COVID virus. And many doctors in the Indian Medical Association were livid with anger. You know, this was not tested properly. And how can this cure when, you know, so many global companies were working for months to produce a vaccine? And now the state of Uttarakhand has now suspended licenses for 14 of the products made by the companies of Baba Ramdev. And some of them, you know, which the companies claim that they could cure bronchitis, asthma and diabetes. Now, this follows a Supreme Court directive, which clearly said that he should apologize for misleading people, and also it pulled up the authorities for not taking action against what the court said were misleading claims of Mr. Ramdev.
Because the Supreme Court has repeatedly criticised him for not complying with its directive. So what happens next?
The court has asked him to issue apology on the newspapers, saying that they were, most of his claims were misleading. In fact, he gave a very small advertisement. So the court again told him give a bigger advertisements, giving his apology. So the case will come up for hearing in the next few weeks, and then the judges will decide what would be the next course of action.
Anbarasan Etirajan, our South Asia regional editor. Next, to a victory for those battling for so-called urination equality in the Netherlands. The city of Amsterdam has announced it is to spend millions on lots more public toilets to complement the relatively plentiful supply of urinals already in place for men. It's a story which began back in 2015, when Geerte Pierning, then aged 21, was on her way home and the need struck. She spoke to Tim Franks.
In 2015, I went out in Amsterdam. It was in the middle of the night. And then I had to pee, but all the bars and cafes and all the other places were closed. And then I couldn't make it to home anymore. Yeah, I searched for an alley. And then I got caught because I was peeing in public. And then I got fined. So that's where it all started.
So you were fined by the police who happened to spot you. What happened then? Did you decide, look, this is completely unfair. I'm not going to pay it. I'm going to take this to court.
Actually, I got the fine and next morning I woke up and I thought it is really weird because I really couldn't find a toilet. And then I did a little research and I found out that there were 35 toilets for men and just 2 public toilets for everyone else in the whole city. And then I thought this isn't really fair, and then I fought the fine, and then 2 years later I had to go to court for that.
Gosh,
for that
so it took 2 years before we came to court, and then what happened in court? Because I mean, that is part of the story, isn't it?
Yes, that is part of the story. So I was in court, and then the judge told me that I could have peed on a men's urinal.
I mean, presumably you didn't laugh in court, but I mean, you must have been, frankly, remarkable thing for somebody to say, who sort of, you imagine, would understand female anatomy to a point.
Yes, I did not laugh at all, but I also didn't know what to say, so I didn't say anything. No. But
tell me how we've got to the point today, because, I mean, it's taken a very, very long time, but how has your campaign worked?
Yeah, we're 7 years after court now. I lost the case in the end, but then after a year, I thought, okay, nothing happened yet. So I had contact with someone from the municipality, from a political party, Ilana Rodekerk.
You started your campaign saying, look, we need urination equality, as the campaign has been talked about. So, I mean, at last, at long, long last, 9 years after this incident, the Amsterdam authorities say that they will build more toilets that are accessible for people with wheelchairs and for women. So it is a victory.
Yes, it's happening. Yeah, they're going to build the first one in October. So that's, yeah, a great thing, I think.
Geerte Pienink talking to Tim Franks. Now, what is the ideal length for a film? Well, recently we've seen some box office hits like Oppenheimer coming in at a whopping 3 hours. But new research in the US suggests that viewers would have been happier if it had been cut in half. Our reporter, Stephanie Prentice, told me the ideal duration for moviegoers seems to be about 90 minutes.
According to this poll, Ollie, it was 2,000 Americans they polled, and they were trying to work out at what point people just switch off when they're watching a film. And they did conclude it's around an hour and a half. And actually, according to the study, only 2% of the people they surveyed would have been happy if a film went on longer than 2.5 hours. Now, this issue actually came up recently with the Martin Scorsese Western Killers of the Flower Moon. That got a lot of hype. People were really excited about it. But the final cut is 3.5 hours long. And some cinemas said they were responding to audience feedback and putting in an intermission in the middle. Martin Scorsese himself shook off criticism of the length, saying, "Give cinema some respect."
Yeah, I mean, I'm happier for films about 90 minutes long, but some hits have broken this rule.
Well, yeah, in terms of pure box office statistics, this new data doesn't really add up because 9 out of 10 of the highest grossing films of all time are 2 hours or longer. And even adjusted for only US audiences, the data shows they're still turning out for those longer movies. If we think of something like Avatar, that's the highest grossing film of all time, made around $3 billion globally, that's more than 2.5 hours long. Titanic, more than 3 hours. In fact, if you'll make your way down the list of the most successful films in the world, you have to get to Minions at number 26, and that's the first one that hits that 90-minute mark. And if you think a little bit differently in terms of things like cultural footprint, you've got those massive epic classics like Lawrence of Arabia or Gone with the Wind, and they're more than 3.5 hours long. But, I mean, could you sit through them?
To be honest, I haven't. I am put off by the length.
Understandable.
But you've actually seen.
I have indeed. I've seen Gone with the Wind. I've enjoyed it. I've actually watched it more than once. So I think I also would contradict this data as well. I think I'd bed in.
I am still convinced that less is more. Stephanie Prentice there. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, 3 lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe. From people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.